Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 346 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the concluding part of a two-part interview, Lucy Caldwell speaks with Anne Morgan about her short stories and writing about Northern Ireland, the impact of parenthood on creative work, the lure of poetry, and the knack of knowing when to stick the knife in with live audiences. You can hear the first part of this interview in our preceding episode 345. We rejoin Lucy and Anne as they discuss Lucy's 2016 short story collection, Multitudes.
The title of the collection, Multitudes, you can't help but think of the Walt Whitman quote, I contain multitudes. Is that what you're saying with this collection, that are these all... I know we talked earlier about the problem of people assuming things are biographical, but are there elements of self in all these stories? Or
yes, these stories actually... When I was at Cultimus doing my master's, I was writing some of these short stories, actually. I had this whole idea, this vision, this book of stories narrated by girls and young women, all set in Belfast, between Belfast and London, and it just didn't work. Short stories are so hard. I think of all the forms I've worked in, they're the hardest. And they just weren't... I finished this rough collection, and it wasn't more than the sum of its parts. It just didn't work. And funnily, there are two stories in Multitudes whose first drafts date back to that collection. There were two specific ideas that I couldn't quite let go. I would occasionally come back to over the years and try to make them work, but it took a long time to have enough of the technique to do what I wanted to do with them. And also to have to believe that the stories that I had to tell, that I wanted to tell, were as valuable as, you know, if you publish young, what a lot of people say to you is, they say, what can you possibly have to write about? You haven't lived. Which I think is equally both true and completely not true at all. You know, you think of Henry James's essay, The Art of Experience, which I always go back to, and he says that a good writer, is just a sort of a spider's web of sensibility, catching everything. He says, try to be someone on whom nothing is lost. And he says that if your sensibilities are finely tuned enough or honed enough, you can bring anything to life. It doesn't have to be connected to you. At the same time, I think my best work are the stories that are more personal, but it took a while to believe that those were worth telling, as well as having the technical element. And I think partly what I wanted to do with that collection was think, when you think of Belfast at that time and place, there are certain images, certain narratives, certain headlines that suck the oxygen from all others. And what I wanted to do with that story is to insist on multiplicity, insist on other ways of being, insist on other lives just as valid lived in that time.
So I remember you once said to me years ago about Where They Were Missed that the troubles would be there like the weather.
That's right, I remember saying that.
And I love that idea, and I think it's so interesting because I'm not a Northern Irish writer, but I imagine there must be a degree of pressure or perhaps expectation from some quarters that you will write about the troubles, you'll write about the history in some way. And I mean, how have you... Is that your way of resisting that, by providing multiple...
Yes, I've felt a great sense of obligation and a great sense of resentment as well. And I felt my first novel, I was pushed to... There's a kind of hokey plot strand in it that I kind of cringe every time I haven't even opened that novel for years, but every time I think about it, that I was pressurised to put in because other people thought it should be there. And yes, so I wanted to insist on... I think we're all the richer for the more various stories we have. There's a writer, a very fine writer that I'm mentoring at the moment, who lives in Belfast, is Muslim, came to Belfast as a teenager and lived in rural... Actually, didn't come to Belfast, lives in Belfast now, came to rural Northern Ireland. And I want to know what it's like being one of the few hijabi teenagers in rural Northern Ireland, celebrating Eid with your family, and the joyful stories and the awful story, you know, all of that, where is that? You know, where is that in any kind of sense of Northern Irishness? Mm. And this writer always says she has such a block because there aren't any other stories like it. And so, of course, then she feels a pressure. She feels a pressure of, you know, representing all Muslims when she writes these stories. And, of course, she doesn't have to. She just has to write her own. Or she doesn't. There's no... You didn't have to write any... But I think there are so many stories about Northern Ireland. You know, one of the stories in Multitudes called Here We Are, about two young teenage girls in love, is based on some friends of mine. But the idea came from watching the time of the equal marriage referendum in the south of Ireland, watching an old lady in her 80s being helped in to vote, and someone interviewed her. And they assumed that she was old and rural and would be conservative and voting no. And she was voting yes. And she said it's because she was never free to live the life that she'd wanted, to love the people that she'd wanted, and she wanted to make sure that wasn't the case for anyone else. And I had this great rush of thinking, we're missing her story. There are so many stories that people haven't told through shame or through not believing that's a story worthy of telling. And so with Multitudes, I wanted to... It felt like a political act to insist on the right of other stories to exist, and maybe particularly women and girls.
Mm, yeah. Are there limits? Are there things you wouldn't write? I mean, there's quite a fraught debate that's been going on for some years in the publishing industry about who has the right to tell which story, authenticity, who's allowed to say what or write which characters. Do you think, are there limits for you? Are there things you wouldn't attempt, or is it all open for a writer?
It's such a tricky question, and I think it changes. The novelist Alexander Chi has a really good essay on asking yourself a series of questions about, if you're telling a story that's far removed from yours, why do you want to tell it? Why are you the person to tell it? Do you have friends that are, you know, of that race or of that sexuality or whatever the case might be that's different from yours? And if not, why? So he goes through and it's interesting with Multitudes, the very central story is a story of a young transgender child. And the stories of Multitudes are all narrated by girls or young women. So when you get to this story, which is the fifth or sixth in the collection, you've become used to, you're expecting them all to be girls. And the story is told in the second person point of view. And so it's not till partway through the story that the reader realises that actually this is someone who thinks of themselves as a girl but is in a boy's body. And with that story, I did research and I spoke to people on forums, and it felt within all the stories that I was writing in Multitudes that had gay teenagers and that had, you know, mixed race love affairs and had all these other things, I wanted to include something that saw gender other than as a fixed, other than a binary. And so the story had its place for those reasons. But I wrote that, I was researching it for a couple of years, and maybe 2012, 2013. The story was finished by, I think it was broadcast in about 2013. Collection was until 2016. But, you know, now, all those years later, I think, would I write a story like that? Quite probably not.
There is one story that stands apart slightly from the others, I think, and that's the title story, the final story, Multitudes, which isn't set in Belfast, actually. It's set in East London, where you live. And I think it's a hugely personal story, drawing on your own experience of your son being sick, isn't it? Is that right? How was it to write about that experience so rawly? So, I mean, it's beautifully controlled, but there's so much power and so much obvious emotion in it.
Yeah, that story was a really important one. That was a sort of breakthrough story. It's the final story in the collection, but it wasn't actually the final one written. My son was very ill shortly after he was born. A couple of times we were in intensive wards, and at one point we were told that he might not make it. And afterwards, when he had come out of hospital, I remember I wrote that story, he was 7 to 8 weeks old. It seems so implausible, but I have the date that I sent it to my editor. And I wrote this story on bursts on my phone at night. And I wrote it with him in a sling with my laptop on the kitchen island. And I wrote it, I would find that if I put on if I put on like Candy Says, for some reason, the song is about 5 or 6 minutes long, and he would sort of fall into a daze, and then I'd have about another 5 or 6 minutes. And so it was written sort of like that, but it felt as if I was writing for survival. I know that we really lack any sort of models, any blueprints for creative motherhood. I think we also lack blueprints for fulfilled, you know, child-free. Like we lack models for women who have chosen not to have children and are fulfilled in so many other ways. There aren't many models either for women who have wanted to have children and haven't been able to and have found fulfillment. Emily Pine's book of essays, Notes to Self, was brilliant because of that. But we do lack models for creative motherhood. And I had been terrified that having a child, you know, the only myth we have is the prime and the hallway, that it kills everything. And so it felt like I was writing for my own survival as a writer, that story. It felt like it was an act of assertion of, I'm still here and we've been through this, but I can write about it. And it was also, I'd been reading, I just discovered Lucia Berlin, I think is extraordinary. And she writes so close to the bone. And she often, in her work, she returns to the same places or incidents or people that, if you know anything of her biography, are very, very thin. They skate the very, very fine line between whether they're real or made up. And it doesn't matter. And she's in stylistic control, and she does, her sentences swoop and pivot, and they do these amazing things. And so I just read her, and it opened up another way to be as a writer. And going back to that idea of models for creative motherhood, I think that what no one does tell you is that any experience that makes you more vulnerable can only make you a better artist. And I found that with new first-time motherhood, especially having a child who was so gravely ill. For a while afterwards, there was this sort of golden period where I did a lot of really, really good work because I just didn't care what anyone thought. Firstly, I was much more vulnerable, but I felt much more invulnerable as well because I could just write things, didn't matter. If someone didn't like it, it just didn't matter. And also I had this renewed sense of the urgency of time. You know, all the projects that I'd always thought I'll do one day, or I'll do when I'm good enough, or I'll do. Suddenly, I think as a new parent, maybe as a parent in general, you're living in time in a different way. And so for me, all of the things came together in that story. And so it felt an important one to write for all those reasons. It felt as if it was a portal that I'd gone through somewhere. I'd found a new way of writing. I found a new way of writing honestly. I'd found a way of writing close to the bone. I'd found a way of writing about things that were so close to me and yet still having enough critical distance to be able to make them into a good piece of work. So I sent the story to my editor at Faber, which is how I have the date on it. And he says that he was absolutely dreading reading it because he knew that my son had been ill, and I said, I've written a story about it. And he was just thinking, this is going to be awful, what do I say? And then he read it, and he said it was brilliant. He said he wouldn't change a word, and he said, and that's your title story. So after I'd written that story, I then went back and wrote a couple more of the stories, like Here We Are, that appear earlier in the book, but that benefited from all the sort of psychic discoveries I'd made through writing Multitudes.
Wow. Gosh, I mean, that's incredible. But I think a lot of women writers I know do, around the time of having that first child, push themselves in all sorts of ways, and it can be an incredibly fertile period. It's amazing how it does change, and I think you're right that there is a need for some more storytelling, more multiple stories around birth.
Yes, there's an absolutely brilliant essay by the Irish writer Claire Kilroy, mm-hmm. who I think is very underread writer, and it's called F is for Phone, and she wrote it for Winter Papers, the anthology edited by Kevin Barry and Olivia Smith, but it was so successful, I think it's online, so I think listeners might be able to hear it or read it. And it's just a searing essay of the trauma of pregnancy and of having a child, and how she lost her sense of self, and actually she hasn't found a way back to writing again. And it's about postnatal depression and about lots of other things again that we don't talk about enough.
Yeah, so interesting. Now, as well as winning many awards, you've been involved with judging quite mm-hmm. a lot of awards. How has that experience influenced your writing? What has it taught you? And what advice might you give to someone who is trying to enter awards?
Most recently, I've judged the BBC National Short Story Award. And the one thing I would say, actually, and a very different award I also judged this year was the BBC Northern Ireland Young Writers Award. So we had, there was a category between 5 and 8, between 10 and 13, you know, up to 16. And I had the same piece of advice for both, which is when people are writing short stories, they tend to be, or people tend to think they have to be, about a death or, you know, bereavement or a breakdown of a marriage or a big thing treated in a serious way. And actually, whether it was the children's stories or the stories for the BBC Awards that are all by writers who have to have published elsewhere, if you could make the judges laugh. And partly that's heightened by the fact that both of these awards were judged during lockdown, during the pandemic. But the stories where you could make someone laugh really stood out. It didn't have, it could be a very wry, dry, gentle humour. Could be a laugh out loud moment, could be, I think it's very hard to write comedy well. It's easier to be sombre, it's easier to be moving, it's easier to be meaningful. But comedy is such an underused tool. And it's something that I learned as a playwright only through having my plays on, that if you can get an audience to laugh, they're instantly together, they're bonded, they're off guard. The next moment is a moment to slip the knife in. And the other thing is that you always assume that it's moving to see a character, especially on stage, but also in a story, crying or upset. And it's not. It's far more effective to see someone trying not to cry, trying to cope. You know, you, if as a writer you write all the emotions, you leave nowhere for the reader to go. But if you show the characters trying not to break down, trying not to give in, the reader is with them, the reader is willing them on.
Yeah, fascinating. Hmm? So interesting. You use language so carefully, you're so precise as a writer, and I'm very interested to hear you talk about the use of the second person, because that's something that I picked up very much in your novel and something in your short stories, and something that I've enjoyed writing with as well. And I wonder if it's something about the time we grew up, what the use of the second person appeals, because it's quite an unusual form to take. But I was wondering whether you've ever been tempted by poetry, as someone who's so precise with language. Is that something you've...
Yes, I always... You've uncovered my darkest secret, because I always wanted to be a poet. At university, I tried to write poetry. I was no good. All of my poems, they started breaking free into longer character pieces, like a sort of Alan Bennett, you know, I mean, Alan Bennett is brilliant, but any, you know, serious, educated, clever poetry I tried to write would always be much more like a talking head style monologue, or it would be, it just obviously, it wasn't poetry. So, yeah, I went character I can do.
Robert Browning, maybe?
Yeah, yeah, I know, exactly. But the U is really interesting, because actually it's one of the forms that I don't like most when I'm reading it, because it's so easy to feel harangued by it as a reader. You know, you are this and you are that. And part of me sort of bristles and thinks, no, I'm not. But the way that I came to use it with my stories is I needed something. I write a lot of first person. I find third very tricky, because I find that if I'm writing third person, I get really tangled up and self-conscious about me being there. You know, who is the point from which this is being observed? Whose consciousness is making these decisions? You know, questions of style, questions of me being present on the page are there in ways that I find uncomfortable. First person I can do, because I'm ventriloquizing character. But then when I needed something a bit more than first person, when I needed to be a notch or so above the awareness of the characters, I found that third person, the way that I imagined my third person, was as incredibly intimate. The reader is there, but the reader is almost not allowed to breathe. The conversation is between the character and the voice in the character's head, or between maybe an older version of the character and the character. So it's got that slightly magical sense, that slight sense of the reader overhearing something, not being addressed directly. And so I think that gives you a story an intimacy, and it gives it a slight tension as well, as if you're overhearing something that matters. You're overhearing the most deeply private moments of something.
Fantastic. Well, there's so much more I'd like to talk about, but I think we're going to have to leave it there. But I thank you so much.
We're about
much.
To have a 3-year-old crashing through the door. From...
Absolutely. But it's been so interesting, Lucy. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And yeah.
Thank you.
That was Lucy Caldwell in conversation with Anne Morgan. You can find out more about Lucy on her website at www.lucycaldwell.com. And that concludes episode 346, which was recorded by Anne Morgan and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 347, Lydia Sisson explores the kinds of truth embodied in fiction and considers its place in historical research. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.